From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, how Ruth Bader Ginsburg became a pop icon and subject of the documentary RBG. The film is up for an Academy Award. Then, even though she's country music royalty, she's a little out of step with tradition-bound Nashville. Roseanne Cash speaks up about gun control.
To me, it's immoral not to say it, to speak my conscience about it, and also to try to do anything I can if one child is exempt from being in a shooting.
All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in today for John Horn. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was back at the Supreme Court today. The now 85-year-old justice missed oral arguments last month while recovering from surgery in December. In RBG, the Oscar-nominated feature documentary, we learned that long before she joined the Supreme Court, Ginsburg was a lawyer who argued cases before the High Court. Many of them had to do with gender equality. Betsy West co-directed RBG with Julie Cohen. When John Horn spoke with West last year, they began with how Ginsburg told the filmmakers about how she responded to sex discrimination that she faced in her own life, and lessons she learned from her mother at a very early age.
Anger is a waste of time. And I think by that she means not that she wouldn't get angry, but that she would move beyond it and try to figure out a way around it. And in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's case, after she was discriminated against and kept out of jobs and denied an opportunity to be a clerk on the Supreme Court because she had been recommended to a justice on the Supreme Court who said, I'm not going to hire a woman. Within a decade of all the discrimination that she faced, she was part of this movement to change the discriminatory laws and customs in our country. And ultimately, she brought a series of lawsuits that really did force the Supreme Court to look at this discrimination that was out there that people really didn't recognize as discrimination. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg brought it to their attention and had a tremendous impact on every woman in this country.
There is an audio recording that you have of then a private lawyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appearing before the court, and she's arguing a case, and I think it's Chief Justice William Rehnquist who says, isn't it enough that Susan B. Anthony is on a coin?
Count equally before the law.
You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar.
And it's not clear that he's totally joking.
Yeah. The kinds of casual, you could say, sexist remarks that were made to her in the course of her work as a litigator appearing before the Supreme Court. We ask her, how did you deal with this kind of dismissive remark? And her response characteristically was never in anger. And then my favorite comment that she made was, I almost felt as if I were a kindergarten teacher explaining to these justices that, yes, discrimination against women exists. It was Justice Ginsburg then as a lawyer explaining to justices, no, you know, women don't have it all. They're not on a pedestal and treated better. The pedestal is often a cage.
It seems to me there would be kind of a fundamental difference between saying we need to make a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg to how do we make a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Because you have to, if you're going to do this well, probably get her cooperation, and Supreme Court justices are famously private.
Well, it was a step-by-step process, let's put it that way. We started, Julie Cohen and I started about 3 years ago. We proposed to Justice Ginsburg that we would like to do a documentary about her life story. And at the time, she said, well, I'm not ready yet. Eventually, 2 years ago, she gave us the green light to go ahead and to film her at some of the events that she does around the country where she speaks to legal groups. And eventually we filmed with her granddaughter, with her family. And then the most fun thing, filming Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her gym doing her legendary workout routine.
I think it's safe to say that when you started this documentary, the world was different than it is today. We did not see the election of Donald Trump, the defeat of Hillary Clinton. We didn't have all of these reports about sexual harassment and assault and rape across popular culture and into government. How do you think that changes the way that her story is relevant and the way your film will be received?
It makes our film more relevant in a way because I think our film and the story of Justice Ginsburg is a context that people need to understand. That it wasn't so long ago that women weren't even allowed into many workplaces. It was a hard-fought battle for women to get the right to use their brains and to contribute their talents to our country. And yet we're learning that sexual harassment and in some cases violence has kept women from really contributing. So it's another stage in a long battle for equal rights for women that's been going on for over a century. Ruth Bader Ginsburg played an enormous role in winning rights for women.
A couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to go to the Supreme Court and hear oral arguments. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a tiny woman. She doesn't have a booming voice, but her questions were remarkably astute. She knew this case backward and forward. What do you think keeps her going?
She loves the law. She absolutely loves it. And that's been the case ever since she was a student at Harvard Law School. Her children talk about waking up in the middle of the night and going into the kitchen, and there was Mom on the dining room table with all the papers spread out, and she's writing into the wee hours. That's still the case, we're told, that she really is a night owl. She is very well prepared, from what I'm told. You come into that courtroom and Justice Ginsburg has read everything. She's got an extraordinary memory, and I think she figures as long as that's the case and she's capable of doing the job, she has no intention of stepping down.
You can watch RBG on Hulu and Amazon, and you can hear interviews with more Academy Award nominees on The Frame's 5th annual Oscar preview special. It starts airing on KPCC tomorrow nights and will be in our podcast feed. Coming up on The Frame, singer-songwriter Roseanne Catt.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. John Horn is off today. Thanks for joining us. She may be country music royalty by birth, but Roseanne Cash doesn't consider herself part of the Nashville mainstream. Over the past 20 years, she's gradually pulled away from the pop-friendly country music that made her a star in the 1980s in favor of a more stripped-down, introspective sound that emphasizes her very personal songwriting. Cash's latest album, She Remembers Everything, caps a trilogy of sorts that began in 2006 with Black Cadillac, an album inspired by the deaths of her mother, her father, Johnny Cash, and stepmom, June Carter Cash. She Remembers Everything continues along a similar path with tender love songs and folky ballads peppered with songs about gun violence and the weight of grief. Cash and I spoke at the fabled Capitol Records building in L.A., her label for the past 25 years, during a break from a lengthy U.S. tour. Cash grew up in nearby Ventura County, and she says it was a household filled with music.
My parents listened to a lot of different kinds of music, particularly my dad. He was somewhat of a musicologist and listened to everything. Even when my brother was born, he started to listen to metal as well, because when my brother liked metal, you know, he listened to that too. I remember he took me to see Strawberry Alarm Clock once. We sat in the front
row. Your father did.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What
you
did
probably
he think?
Don't even know who
Strawberry. I remember.
You
I
do?
Remember.
Okay. And when Joni Mitchell's Blue came out,
right,
it occurred to me that a woman could be a songwriter. Up to that point, I kind of thought, well, only men are songwriters. You know, that was the only experience that I had. And not only could a woman be a songwriter, but she could write about her inner life with these vivid scenes and raw feelings, turn it into art, and put it out in a public sphere and have it be legitimate and people take it seriously. That was a revelation. That changed my life. Mm. And I started writing poetry, and then at 18 started writing songs.
Oh, I see. Well, if I understand right, when you were still a teenager, your father brings you and your stepsister out on tour with him.
That's
right. And you end up being a backup singer.
Mm-hmm. Terrible one, too.
Yeah. I mean, is that something that you wanted, or is it something that he wanted? How did that come about?
It was really just like having fun with my dad. You know, he's like, well, come, you girls come out on stage at the end and just sing on that. I mean, he was used to having family around. The Carter family was on the road with him, my stepmother, you know. Yeah. So we just did it for fun, and we were trembling with fear. It wasn't professional in any way. But I did start writing songs around that time, and then one thing led to another.
Well, your first appearance on a record, I think, is on your dad's 1974 album, The Junkie and the Juicehead Minus Me.
Mm-hmm. Real family title, right?
Yeah. And you sing Broken Freedom Song, which is a Kris Kristofferson song. I don't know if you've gone back and listened to that.
No.
Any time in the recent past.
No.
But who was that Roseanne Cash?
Oh my God, she was a child.
I got a song about a sister waiting somewhere by the phone.
And I was terrified of being a singer, to tell you the truth. Terrified. But I look at people, young people now, you know, 18, 20-year-old singer-songwriters who are so confident, and I stand in awe. Like, how did they get there at that young?
So you didn't know then, at that time, this is what you wanted to do? So when did that start?
It did start
dawning
then
on you.
It started dawning on me then, but I had no idea how to do it or how to become better yet. And also, I didn't want to be a performer. I wanted to be a songwriter. Mm-hmm. I thought that I could live in a private world and send songs out into the world that other people would record, and that, you know, these depth charges of emotion would be set with my lyrics. And, you know, and then one thing led to another. I started writing songs, and then I got this recording contract, and then I was performing.
Just tell them you're trying to cure a 7-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? But girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
We're talking with Roseanne Cash. Her latest album is She Remembers Everything. a theme that's run through a lot of your work in recent years is grief.
Yeah.
And in 2003, within a short period of time, you lost your father, Johnny Cash, your stepmom, June Carter Cash, and a stepsister, Rosie Nix.
Yeah, and my then
and
my
then
mother.
Your mother in 2005.
Yeah.
I've talked to other artists who've tried to deal with their grief in their art. And what I'm wondering is grief for you a fuel, in a sense, for creativity, or is it a has it been a hindrance?
Well, I mean, when I wrote Black Cadillac, that album was about mourning and loss and death. And, you know, some part of me thought people are not going to want to hear this. It's too dark, but I have to do it even if it's for myself because these are the songs I wrote and they're powerful to me. Well, people started coming up to me, thanking me. Thank you. I lost my dad. This helped me. Then I started hearing from hospice nurses, thank you. We gave this out to families, you know. And that was incredibly humbling and beautiful because you think you're so special and you have original emotions. No, it's universal.
Personal aside, I don't like to get personal in interviews. But
yeah, come on, get personal.
I lost both my parents and two very close friends all in a very short period of time. And
I'm sorry.
You know, and before then, songs and music like this didn't speak to me the way it did before. And I'm a great lover of music. So I'm one of the ones that would like to thank you
for doing that. I'm so sorry. You know, I wrote about loss in my memoir, too. I said, loss is the terrible club to which we all eventually belong. Because you live long enough, you lose.
Well, I was struck by a line in your new record, She Remembers Everything. It's from the song Everyone But Me.
Mother.
And I got that. But when I look at the words, I don't quite get it. But I got it.
And that's it, really. It's like you don't necessarily have to get the exact meaning of the words to get it. That one was just this amorphous feeling like their lives with me didn't seem long enough and yet too long because some of the after effects are difficult to resolve in yourself, you know? Some of the traumas that you live with that you spend your life trying to either get away from or heal, and there's both rage and grief in it, you know?
There was a song you recorded last year for this record, Johnny Cash Forever Words.
Yeah.
And these are songs by various artists, very well-known artists, Willie Nelson and on, who took poems or existing lyrics that Johnny Cash had written but had not recorded. You created a song called The Walking Wounded.
We're in the church house kneeling down. We're in the subways underground.
I usually say no to all of these kinds of projects because it's not my job to feed my father's posthumous career. So this came along, this Forever Words project, and my brother was spearheading it. So he sent me four or five lyrics, and I saw The Walking Wounded, and it just pierced my heart. It was so revealing of where my dad was in that time in his life, and it was very dark. He was identifying himself as one of the walking wounded, you know, like veterans with PTSD or people who were alone. And so I called my brother and I said, yeah, I'll work on this one.
We lost our homes, we lost our dreams. All our goals have turned to schemes.
You know, my dad had periods of great darkness and also great redemption and light, of course. And I think that that's what people respond to about him, is that he was complex and that he carried both dark and light.
Where are you on that spectrum within yourself?
definitely both, but I try so hard to be normal. I can't tell you how hard I try to do that. In fact, from childhood, I would read books about how normal people lived and try to pattern my life after that.
I think we're good. Anything else that you wanted to...
Before I start crying, yes. Yeah, it's good.
Actually, there is more to add. Coming up, more of my interview with singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash and why she advocates for gun control through music.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in today for John Horn. Back to my conversation with singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. In 2017, Cash drew a lot of criticism and a lot of praise for an opinion piece she wrote for the New York Times. It called on country music artists to distance themselves from the National Rifle Association. And after last year's mass shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, she tweeted in part, "I don't want to hear about thoughts and prayers. I want gun control now." It's a sentiment expressed with the help of Kris Kristofferson and Elvis Costello in this song, Eight Gods of Harlem, off her latest album.
Rain falls on the paramedics, but they do not go inside. The street is where it all went down. The street is where he lies.
Well, you know, I've been an activist for gun control for over 20 years. And as far in my mind, an extension of mothering, really. So I live in New York City. I was going down in the subway one day, and this Hispanic woman was coming up, and she was talking to herself. And I don't speak Spanish, but I thought she said, Ocho Dios, eight gods. And I kept thinking, why would she say that? What does that mean? I couldn't get it out of my mind. And then I heard about another shooting of a child, and I wrote this first verse for Eight Gods of Harlem, and I wrote it from the perspective of the mother. I kept thinking about doing a song with Kris and Elvis, and they both wanted to. And I said, would you be interested in finishing this song? I've got this one verse. And Kris, would you write in the voice of the father?
Blood was on the hand. Nothing on the news.
And Elvis right in the voice of the brother.
The brother in a picture frame. And someone starts to scream. We pray to the God.
And they wrote their verses and we recorded the song in the same day.
After the mass shooting at the Borderline Club in Thousand Oaks last year, this wasn't too far from where you grew up.
Yeah.
You tweeted in part, 12 killed. I don't want to hear about thoughts and prayers. I want gun control now. Speaking today, right now, what kind of legislative change would you like to see?
Really reasonable, common sense laws. Universal background checks, close the gun show loophole, ban assault weapons, ban military-style weapons from being owned by private citizens. The Second Amendment does not guarantee the right to own an arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. That is common sense. And start there.
Mm. You know, I know you don't consider yourself a commercial country artist.
No.
You feel you're sort of outside of Nashville. But at the same time, you're country music royalty. And I know you've called on Nashville to resist efforts by the NRA to reach out to country artists for lobbying efforts, marketing efforts. In your time in the music business, what kind of efforts have you seen the NRA make, these, you know, inroads to music artists?
Oh, they want to sponsor tours, and they have. They function as corporate sponsors for country music shows. And, you know, what's particularly insidious there is that they've woven together this idea of patriotism and gun ownership. And I find it incredibly insulting. I consider myself profoundly patriotic, and I am all for gun control.
Well, I've seen people invoke your father's name in their criticism of you, saying, "Hey, man, Johnny Cash owns some guns."
Oh, really? Were they behind the door when my dad and I talked about politics at 5 in the morning while we watched CNN? I don't think so. And not only that, he was on the board with me of an organization that was devoted solely to preventing gun violence among children.
What kind of response did you get from Nashville artists specifically? Was there any? I was aware of some who spoke out after Las Vegas, after the massacre there at this country music festival. Some of the artists who were actually on stage for that festival. Did your effort, your call for action, get any traction?
I don't think so. I think that the people who are already of like minds, they contacted me and said, "Thank you for saying this. I appreciate it." There was one young man, a musician who was at the Las Vegas shooting, who did reach out to me. And he was so devastated and brokenhearted. And he said, privately, "I've changed my mind. You know, I used to believe that we all should be able to have whatever gun we want. I don't believe that anymore." But going public, I know that some people who are not total mainstream country have spoken out, but going public is dangerous.
How so?
Death threats, not just the verbal attacks, you know. I mean, I got death threats. Someone threatened my daughter. It just, at this point, I just can't not say it. To me, it's immoral not to say it and to speak my conscience about it, and also to try to do anything I can if one child is exempt from, you know, being in a shooting or saved, then it's worth it.
Roseanne Cash, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Roseanne Cash's latest album is She Remembers Everything. She's on tour through the spring, including a performance this Sunday at the Soraya Theater at Cal State Northridge. And that'll do it for us this week. You can catch The Frame's daily podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. Subscribe so you can make sure you never miss an episode. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk, Valentino Rivera is our engineer, and I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Dusty books and quiet dreams.
Pictures on the mantle. Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year. Now playing.